This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest-running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry. I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this woman's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of war and racial discrimination that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13.
Even though she'd been at sea for nearly 3 weeks, Iva Taguri still hadn't been able to adjust to the constant rocking of the giant army transport ship.
She clung to the rim of an open porthole, trying to get a better view of the horizon. The slight aroma of dead fish on the salty air turned her stomach further, but Iva held fast.
Soon enough, she was rewarded. Through the fog, the twin red pillars of the Golden Gate Bridge appeared. Iva had been stranded in Japan for over 7 years, and now, in September of 1948, she was finally returning to the United States.
Her eyes welling, Iva forced herself to take another deep breath of the reeking but all-American air.
She thought about what brought her to this moment. Tokyo Rose. Iva had claimed the identity 3 years prior under the promise of a $2,000 payout, thinking the money would help her get back to the U.S.
In a way, Iva's plan had worked. She was coming home.
She just hadn't expected to be returning as a war criminal, suspected of treason.
Picture a murderer, a gangster, a thief. Did you picture a woman? We didn't think so. Society associates men with dangerous crimes. But what happens when the perpetrator is female? Every Wednesday, we examine the psychology, motivations, and atrocities of female criminals.
Hi, I'm Sammy Nye.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And you're listening to Female Criminals on the Parcast Network. Today, we're continuing our exploration into the life of Iva Taguri, who claimed to be Tokyo Rose in 1945. But when journalists wrote articles about Tokyo Rose, they labeled her as a traitor.
We'll take a closer look at the aftermath of these claims, Iva's multiple arrests, and eventual trial for treason against the U.S.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
On August 31st, 1945, Iva Taguri was contacted by her husband's friend, Leslie Nakashima. Knowing about her time at Radio Tokyo, he told her that two journalists were offering $2,000 in exchange for an interview with Tokyo Rose.
Iva met with Clark Lee and Henry Brundage early in September 1945 to tell her story. She signed a contract stating that she was the one and only true Tokyo Rose, even though she knew it was not true.
It's important to understand why she would lie. $2,000 was a small fortune. To put things in perspective, when Iva left America in 1941, rice cost 9 cents a pound. A movie ticket was 25 cents, and medical care cost an average of $100 a year.
Iva knew that someone was bound to step forward and claim it. If it could help her return home to the U.S., what was the harm in telling a white lie?
Vanessa's going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Sammy. It's possible Iva justified her reasoning through the self-deception technique of rationalization. According to the DSM-5, rationalization occurs by concealing the true motivations for one's own thoughts, actions, or feelings through the elaboration of reassuring or self-serving but incorrect explanations.
She was able to rationalize stretching the truth because she didn't think she was doing anything wrong. Iva felt she had honored her country by subverting the propaganda messages with her delivery. In a way, she deserved the $2,000 for her service to her country.
The story ran in the Los Angeles Examiner with a headline reading, "Traitors Pay. Tokyo Rose Got $100 a Month." Overnight, Tokyo Rose was a pariah.
Meanwhile, more reporters were clamoring to hear from Iva. On September 3rd, Dale Kramer and James Keeney from Yank Magazine visited Iva at home for an interview.
She initially refused due to the headline of Lee's article. However, Yank was created by the United States military for an intended veteran audience. After considering that she would be able to speak to the people who had enjoyed listening to her broadcasts, she agreed to an interview.
This indicates that Iva could have also been motivated by fame, not just the $2,000. Iva saw these soldiers as her fans.
The draw of fame is incredibly strong and can lead to rash decision-making. According to behavioral expert Dr. Mark D. Griffiths, fame is an addiction. For many, it's the same as drugs or alcohol, and in the same vein as those vices, can easily take over your ideals and mentality.
With this interview, she was being offered the chance to speak directly to the people who tuned in to hear her week after week. The people who were clamoring to know who she was. The draw was surely intoxicating.
Following the interview, Kramer and Keeney suggested that Iva hold a press conference for all the Allied news outlets. They argued that there were many reporters interested in her story, and this would be easier than granting individual interviews to all of them.
Iva agreed. And on September 5th, 1945, just a day after her initial interview with Lee and Brundage, Kramer and Keeney took Iva to a hotel in Yokohama for a 30-minute press conference with more than 100 correspondents.
It is possible that Iva realized how popular she had become and thought she could leverage that demand in exchange for more money. This is something we see commonly now. For example, people of interest who pen memoirs.
It's also possible that Iva was motivated to use the interviews in order to clear her name. Iva's decision to continually tell her story to reporters was, potentially, her way of reclaiming her agency.
The reporters' questions in the press conference initially focused on Iva's biography. Then they shifted to her time at Radio Tokyo, including questions about an alleged recording in which she insinuated that the wives and girlfriends of American GIs were being unfaithful during the war.
Iva was shocked to hear such accusations and vehemently denied them.
However, many news outlets falsely quoted her. They were perpetuating the treason storyline for reasons similar to Clark Lee's. It was a better headline.
The unmasking of Tokyo Rose had led to nationwide interest in Iva back in the States, as the lore of her treason ballooned.
Unfortunately, she'd also drawn the attention of military counterintelligence. After Brundage sent his information to Brigadier General Thorpe, the 8th Army had opened an investigation into Iva.
As Iva and her husband Philippe were leaving the press conference, they were stopped by an 8th Army sergeant.
He informed them that Iva was suspected of treason, and they were both under arrest.
Iva and Philippe were brought to the Yokohama Customs House under the orders of Brigadier General Elliot Thorpe.
Iva was questioned briefly by Thorpe, but it was late in the day, so the conversation was cut short. She and Philippe were taken to a room at the Grand Hotel in Yokohama to stay overnight. Iva's defense lawyer would later claim that this was arrest without a warrant, but at the time, she didn't think anything of it.
Shortly after their arrival at the hotel, a military policeman came to the room to confirm there were no possible escape routes. Before stepping out to stand guard, he asked Iva for her autograph.
On the following day, September 6th, she was questioned again for several hours. Iva continued to deny that she made any anti-Allied comments on air.
She was taken for fingerprinting and eventually released into the custody of her husband. The two subsequently returned to Tokyo with the help of an army escort.
Iva thought that her conversations with Thorpe had cleared her name, but rumors continued to swirl regarding Tokyo Rose, perpetuated by the American GIs who claimed to have heard her broadcasts. They said she shared the locations of secret military bases and troop movements.
Public officials called for action against Toguri, including U.S. Attorney Charles H. Carr. On September 13, 1945, he held a press conference in Los Angeles, demanding that Iva be extradited and tried in federal court for treason.
Carr's desire to ride the wave of growing resentment towards Iva was probably motivated by politics. Southern California, at the time, had a fair amount of anti-Japanese sentiment, and these kind of statements may have been an attempt to gain supporters.
Carr's press conference made national news, further cementing the connection between Iva and Tokyo Rose. This was also the first time a public official had identified her as a traitor on the record.
On October 11th, 1945, 6 weeks after Lee's article was published, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover officially declared Iva Toguri a suspect of treason against the United States.
6 days later, on October 17th, Iva had just finished washing her hair when she heard a knock at the door. Three counterintelligence officers were there to bring her back to Yokohama for questioning. Iva went with them without resistance.
Once at Yokohama, however, she was detained in the 8th Army Brig. They interrogated her, asking questions such as, "Did you advise the Japanese government on their propaganda warfare?"
Iva continually insisted that she was not a central figure in wartime Japan, simply a radio announcer. But the officers were dubious. After all, the Tokyo Rose they had heard so much about was famously a liar.
Officers were also skeptical about her nationality because she couldn't provide the necessary documentation.
They were confused how they should treat her. Should she be given a Western bed or a Japanese futon, American food or Japanese food? It was all incredibly frustrating for Iva.
After a month in Yokohama, Iva was brought out of her cell. For a brief moment, as a guard walked her toward the exit, she thought she was being released.
Instead, she was loaded into a car, bound for Sugamo Prison. Iva Toguri was to be held with the rest of Japan's war criminals. Coming up, an FBI investigator arrives in Japan to question Iva about her involvement in propaganda.
Now, back to the story. In November of 1945, 29-year-old Iva Toguri was being held in Sugamo Prison as a war criminal. She was suspected of broadcasting Japanese propaganda during World War II after claiming the moniker Tokyo Rose.
Her cell in Sugamo was 6 feet by 9 feet, with a toilet and wash basin that could be converted into a table when covered with a board.
She was denied any explanation for her arrest, as well as access to legal counsel.
Her husband, Philippe, was allowed to visit once a month. He brought her gifts and as much food as he could manage. Iva asked him to retain a lawyer, but it was difficult to find someone in Japan who was familiar with the American legal system.
Not knowing how long she would be in captivity, surrounded by guards who didn't speak English, and denied contact with her husband, Iva's time in Sugamo was comparable to the conditions of solitary confinement. Researcher Michael Bauer described the effect of solitary confinement on inmates as a prison within a prison.
According to Bauer, long-term solitary confinement can lead to increased anxiety, depression, and suicidality. In a 1993 study, 35 of 55 inmates who showed these symptoms after a prolonged stay in solitary confinement had long-term emotional effects that did not dissipate even after an extended period of time.
Iva said being in prison without charge or access to counsel was worse than physical torture.
One small bright spot in Sugamo was the steam bath she was allowed to take every 3 days. However, on one such occasion, she noticed faces pressed up against the frosted windows that looked into the bathroom.
Iva screamed, attracting the attention of a nearby guard. Upon investigating, he discovered that the peeping eyes belonged to a group of congressmen visiting Japan. They were observing other war criminals when they heard that Tokyo Rose herself was taking a bath and quickly came to catch a glimpse.
6 months after her arrest, there was finally some movement in Iva's case. On April 30, 1946, FBI agent Frederick Tillman came to Sugamo to question her. Iva welcomed the opportunity to tell her side of the story. She hoped, rather naively, that they would understand the mistake and let her go.
As she spoke, Tillman typed up her answers for the official record. He later reported that he found Iva to be incredibly cooperative in the interview.
Tillman also brought along some old broadcasting scripts that Philippe had provided to the authorities to review. Iva asserted that she and her Radio Tokyo colleagues had made their intentions clear through the sarcastic and playful delivery of the script.
For example, Iva frequently called American GIs honorable boneheads in her broadcasts. She explained how Cousins coached her to speak in a bantering way to come across like an older sister teasing her younger brothers.
Likewise, with the delivery of her sign-off, your favorite enemy, Anne, the tone was self-deprecating, never serious.
But Tillman's demeanor through the interview was unreceptive. He asked some questions over and over, and often in a mocking tone. He continuously pressed Iva on her answers. By the end, she was certain he doubted everything she said.
Tillman let Iva review the typed pages of her statement. Once she approved of what he'd written, she signed it. He told her she would know whether or not she was to be indicted for treason in approximately 6 weeks.
But the weeks came and went, and Iva didn't hear anything.
As it turns out, the 8th Army Counterintelligence had already come to a conclusion regarding her guilt 3 days before Tillman even arrived in Japan to interrogate her.
On April 27th, they had submitted Iva's file to the Justice Department with the recommendation that she be released from Sugamo.
Information gathered by the 8th Army proved that Iva was clearly not Tokyo Rose, if such a person ever even existed.
There was no evidence that she ever broadcast under that name, nor that she ever indicated knowledge of private military information at all.
However, the damage was done as far as the public was concerned. It would be impossible to separate Iva from the false identity that she had assumed.
While Iva sat in jail day by day, month by month, without any legal counsel or updates to her situation, her file made its way through the red tape in Washington. Her fate, at that point, was up in the air.
Finally, on October 4th, nearly 6 months after Tillman's interrogation, it was decided that there was not enough evidence to warrant prosecution for treason.
On the evening of October 25th, Iva walked out of Sugamo and into a sea of camera flashes. It seemed as if her troubles were finally over. She was innocent, and authorities recognized that her connection to Tokyo Rose was erroneous.
She smiled brightly at the waiting reporters, excited to return to her normal life. And in the weeks following her release from prison, she did just that.
But Iva never enjoyed living in Japan, and she was desperate to return to America. Philippe cautioned against trying to return so quickly after her release. He wanted to wait until some of the excitement surrounding Tokyo Rose had died down.
But Iva had always held the assertion that she did nothing wrong. Now that the authorities had validated her innocence, she stubbornly ignored Philippe's warning. She went to the American consulate in December 1946 to verify her citizenship and apply for repatriation to the United States.
But once again, Iva was told she lacked documentation to prove her citizenship. The American vice consul went so far as to call her a stateless person.
Iva suddenly found herself back at square one, feeling just as hopeless and alone as she had in 1941 when she was initially stranded in Japan.
She applied again in May 1947. This time, she was told there would be a long delay due to an influx of applications from people in situations similar to Iva's. An estimated 10,000 Nisei, a person of Japanese descent born in America, had been stranded in Japan during the war. Just like Iva, they were caught between the two countries and rejected by both.
To make matters worse, the press caught wind of Iva's attempts to return home, bringing Tokyo Rose back into the public eye.
A news item in November 1947 claimed that Iva was pregnant and attempting to return home so that her child could be born and raised as an American citizen.
Iva was, in fact, pregnant, the baby due in January. The press had gathered this information from a letter she sent to a friend. The rest had been sensationalized.
Public animosity toward Iva had not improved since her release. Most Americans still considered her to be a traitor. In a letter to the Attorney General, Congressman Frank Havener wrote, quote, "That woman gave up her right to ever set foot again on American soil when she made her first broadcast as Tokyo Rose. You cannot teach young America that the reward for treason is to be welcomed home, forgiven, and allowed to give the wonderful gift of American birth to children," end quote.
Much of the outcry against Iva was unofficially led by powerful radio personality and newspaper columnist Walter Winchell.
Winchell was a sensationalist reporter who got his start as a gossip columnist. He became somewhat of a champion for the people, frequently exposing the transgressions of the elite in his columns.
He eventually became the host of a weekly radio program, gaining him an even larger audience. The following is an example of his famous fast-talking and ruthless delivery.
New York. The two New Yorkers, S. Cadell and his daughter Marie, whose espionage activities for Germany were exposed by the FBI, will be sentenced on March the 1st. They may each get 20 years. That's not enough.
According to the Chicago Tribune, Winchell was the most popular and powerful journalist in America of his time, with an estimated 50 million Americans out of an adult population of 75 million either listening to his weekly radio broadcast or reading his column.
That number included Franklin D. Roosevelt, who invited Winchell to the White House following his 1932 presidential election. Soon after, Winchell was Roosevelt's biggest supporter, becoming a mouthpiece for the administration. Winchell quickly found a place within the political sphere and began working closely with J. Edgar Hoover. The two would pass tips back and forth regularly.
Winchell personally took up the cause against Iva in 1947. He had received a letter from the mother of a deceased GI detailing her outrage that Tokyo Rose was attempting to get back into the States.
Winchell had been incredibly outspoken on Nazis and other groups he considered to be enemies of democracy. So this vendetta towards Iva was right up his alley. Winchell reprimanded President Truman on air for his failure to reopen the case.
With Winchell lobbying hard against Iva, the Justice Department found themselves in a tricky predicament. President Truman's popularity was at an all-time low. An attack from the powerful and persuasive Winchell was the last thing the administration needed before re-election. It certainly didn't help that Truman had previously been accused of being soft on traitors.
With this combination of factors, Attorney General Tom Clark stated that he would consider reopening the Tokyo Rose case. The FBI was instructed to begin collecting evidence against Iva.
On January 5, 1948, Iva gave birth in the relatively primitive conditions of a post-war Japanese hospital. The baby died almost immediately.
Iva and Philippe took time to mourn their loss and held off on further pursuit of a return visa.
But in the months that followed, public fervor surrounding the Tokyo Rose case grew. Winchell continued his campaign against her.
The FBI had not found any new evidence in their investigation, but A.G. Clark ultimately decided to arrest Iva under extreme public pressure.
On August 16th, the New York Times front page read, "Arrest of Tokyo Rose ordered."
The article stated, quote, "The Department of Justice chief asked that the Army arrest Iva Taguri Dekino and transport her to San Francisco, where a grand jury will be convened to determine if she should be tried for treason," end quote.
On August 26th, Iva was presented with a warrant charging her with treasonable conduct against the United States government during World War II. She was arrested and taken back to Sugamo Prison.
Once again, Iva found herself alone in a small cell in Sugamo Prison, trying to reassure herself with the truth. She was not guilty, so she did not need to worry.
On September 3, 1948, Iva was loaded onto an Army transport ship bound for San Francisco. Her husband, Philippe, was not told about her departure until the day after she left, so he was unable to say goodbye to her.
The Justice Department's decision to try Iva on the West Coast, particularly in San Francisco, was deliberate. The city had a long history of anti-Japanese sentiment that had only been amplified by World War II.
After a 7-year wait, Iva finally arrived back in America on September 25th, though, of course, her return as an accused criminal was far from ideal.
She was taken to U.S. Commissioner Francis S. J. Fox's office to be arraigned. Waiting for her was a small but mighty welcoming party. Her father, June, and her sister, also named June.
Iva and her father, June, tightly embraced, finally reunited after the long years apart. So much had changed. June had aged and looked incredibly small to Iva. Likewise, June hardly recognized the woman who stood in front of him. When Iva left for Japan, she was healthy and plump. The woman who greeted him now was thin and pale.
June told Iva that he was proud of her, stating, "You didn't change your stripes. A tiger can't change its stripes, but a person can so easily."
Standing next to June was Wayne M. Collins, a lawyer June had recruited to Iva's case. Collins had a reputation for being a champion of the underdog. Iva was thrilled to finally have someone representing her.
While waiting for her trial to begin, Iva kept herself busy in prison. June came to visit every day, bringing a selection of her favorite foods. Iva began to relax a little for the first time in ages.
On October 8, 1948, Iva was charged with committing 8 overt acts with treasonable intent and for the purpose of treason, and with the intent in her to adhere and give aid and comfort to the Imperial Japanese government.
The grand jury vote to move forward with a trial for Iva was a clear majority.
With the eyes of the nation upon them, the Justice Department started to build their case that Iva Taguri committed treason against the United States. Coming up, we'll see the trial unfold.
Now, back to the story. On October 8, 1948, 32-year-old Iva Taguri was formally charged with 8 overt acts of treason against the United States. Desperate to secure a conviction in these very public proceedings, the Justice Department did whatever possible to stack the deck in their favor.
Presiding over Iva's trial was Judge Michael J. Roche, nicknamed Iron Mike, for his sharp and prickly courtroom manner. He had also earned a reputation for being a rather discriminatory judge.
In jury selection, the prosecution went out of their way to secure an all-white jury of 6 men and 6 women.
They also spent thousands of dollars on witnesses willing to speak out against Iva. Foreign witnesses received $10 a day, while domestic witnesses received $12. With inflation, that comes out to approximately $100 and $125 per day, respectively.
71 witnesses, 19 of them Japanese, traveled to San Francisco to testify against Iva.
The defense submitted their own witness list, as is customary, but FBI agent Fred Tillman, who interrogated Iva in Sugamo in 1946, contacted all of the defense's witnesses in advance of the trial, threatening and harassing them to dissuade them from testifying.
Iva did have one person in her corner, however, Major Charles Cousins. After reading about Iva's trial in the paper, he felt obligated to testify on her behalf. Iva's father partially paid for his travel expenses from Australia.
On July 5, 1949, the day after Iva's 33rd birthday, the trial began. Leading the prosecution was Tom DeWolf, a man familiar with charges of treason.
DeWolf had previously prosecuted the cases of Douglas Chandler and Robert Best. They were both accused of broadcasting Nazi propaganda during World War II. Both men received life sentences.
To the Justice Department, he was the obvious choice for the trial of Tokyo Rose.
However, in Iva's case, DeWolf knew she was innocent. A few months before the trial, he sent a memo stating, quote, "There was no proof available that when Iva Taguri committed said acts of broadcasting, she intended to betray the United States," end quote.
Despite these statements, DeWolf followed the orders of his superior, the Attorney General, and proceeded with the trial. On July 6, 1949, DeWolf delivered a 90-minute opening address highlighting the severity of Iva's treason. He reminded the jury that it was the only crime that the Founding Fathers had felt the need to define in the Constitution.
DeWolf asserted that Iva voluntarily remained in Japan during the war. He would show the jury that she knowingly participated in propaganda broadcasts under the name Tokyo Rose and did so with malicious intent, attempting to demoralize American GIs and undermine the war effort.
He called his first witness, Richard J. Eisenhart, a guard at Yokohama Prison at the time of Iva's imprisonment. He testified that when he asked Iva for an autograph, she signed a 1-yen note as Tokyo Rose. DeWolf then presented the signed bill to the jury as evidence.
On July 30th, the court was able to hear recordings from Iva's Orphan Anne broadcasts. Finally, everyone heard for themselves the voice of the so-called treacherous propagandist.
Six recordings were played, sandwiched between songs were various quips by Iva. Perhaps the most vicious of them all was one in which she stated, quote, "Greetings, everybody. How are my victims this evening?" End quote.
None of the recordings seemed malicious in tone or nature, and these were selections carefully curated by the government to prove their point. It was far from the evil narrative the prosecution was attempting to paint of Iva.
Following this, Iva's lawyer, Wayne Collins, was able to disprove statements from 33 ex-GIs who had all claimed to have heard Orphan Anne's broadcasts. None could recall hearing her name. It was a glimmer of hope for Iva.
But DeWolf had two more key witnesses, Kenkichi Oki and George Hideo Mitsushio, overseas bureau staff members in charge of Zero Hour.
Oki and Mitsushio provided testimony implicating Iva in all 8 overt acts of treason she was charged with. The most important of these was Overt Act 6, which alleged that on an unknown date in October of 1944, Iva prepared a script regarding a loss of American ships during a battle in Leyte Gulf.
Mitsushio said he gave her a release from the Imperial General Headquarters with the information, and she had agreed to allude to it in her broadcast.
Oki testified that Iva said a variation of the following during the broadcast. Quote, "Now you fellows have lost all your ships. Now you really are orphans of the Pacific. How do you think you will ever get home?" End quote.
Both Oki and Mitsushio testified that they watched Iva type the words in a script. Iva strongly denied that she ever wrote or broadcasted such a script. It's possible that those words were actually said on Zero Hour, just not by Iva, as there were several other women announcers.
On August 13th, the prosecution rested. Wayne Collins opened his arguments by stating Iva's broadcasts were delivered under duress or threat, with no treasonous intent behind them.
More importantly, they would prove that Iva's Orphan Anne broadcasts were completely separate from Tokyo Rose, who existed only in rumor.
Major Cousins was the first on the stand. He stated that Iva helped him and the other POWs stay alive when there was a desperate food shortage. But Judge Roche ruled this testimony as irrelevant to her treason charges.
Next, Cousins read from a zero-hour script, his inflection just as he had instructed Iva to read it. Judge Roche was unmoved.
two more zero-hour POWs followed, Wallace Ince and Norman Reyes. They both corroborated Cousins' testimony about coaching their delivery.
On September 7th, Iva took the stand herself. She reiterated the facts of her story, as she had so many times over the past few years. Most importantly, that she had no intent to betray the United States.
The defense rested on September 19th. After 56 days of proceedings, the cost of the trial for the government had reached over $750,000. That would be over $9 million today.
Judge Roche gave final instructions to the jury before dismissing them to deliberate on a verdict, saying, quote, "In order to excuse a criminal act on the ground of coercion, compulsion, or necessity, one must have acted under the apprehension of immediate and impending death or serious and immediate bodily harm. That one committed a crime merely because he or she is ordered to do so is no defense," end quote.
Days passed in slow measures as everyone awaited the jury's verdict.
Finally, on September 29th, after 78 hours and 20 minutes of deliberation, the jury filed into the room. The courtroom quickly fell silent.
The court clerk, James Welch, read the jury's findings aloud. He counted through the overt acts, assigning a ruling for each. Overt Act 1, not guilty. Overt Act 2, not guilty.
Iva held her breath as the judgments rattled off, daring to hope. Until...
Overt Act 6, guilty.
There was a collective gasp at the announcement. Some women openly wept. Iva slumped into her seat and stared at her hands, seemingly numb. She was the seventh person in the history of the United States to be convicted of treason.
The jury was swayed by Oki and Mitsushio's testimony regarding the broadcast about ships lost in battle, even though this was not one of the six recordings played in court.
A recording of Iva saying those words did not exist, but it didn't matter. Tokyo Rose's guilt, and therefore Iva's, was long before decided in the court of public opinion.
Iva's story is truly a cautionary tale of cultural cognition, a psychological theory that says we shape our opinions and values based on the group we most closely identify with, regardless of the facts presented. Harvard psychology professor David Ropeek explains that the more threatened a person feels, the more tightly they will hold to their group's opinion. It's a social reflex to find protection in our tribe.
After Pearl Harbor and World War II, there was extreme anti-Japanese sentiment in the United States. Iva, identifying herself as Tokyo Rose, and the press identifying Tokyo Rose as a traitor, confirmed that the Japanese were the enemy.
Once this association was affirmed, even overwhelming evidence to the contrary couldn't sway public opinion.
On October 6, 1949, Judge Roche delivered Iva's sentence. 10 years imprisonment, a fine of $10,000, and she was stripped of her American citizenship. She was transported to Alderson Prison in West Virginia to serve out her sentence.
Iva's time in Alderson passed relatively quickly, thanks in part to frequent visits from her family.
She applied 3 times for the Supreme Court to review her case, but was denied each time.
Iva served more than 6 years of her 10-year sentence and was released on January 28, 1956, at 39 years old. Iva had hoped to finally return to a private life in Chicago following her release. However, she knew from experience that the public wouldn't let her off that easy.
Dozens of reporters awaited Iva outside of the prison upon her release. The public imagination still couldn't let go of Tokyo Rose, despite Iva's repeated attempts to rid herself of the moniker.
Even after she was released from prison, she continued fighting to clear her name. The Justice Department harassed her for payment of the $10,000 fine. It was eventually paid from June's estate when he died in 1972.
In 1976, Iva's case was re-examined. The 30,000-member Japanese-American Citizens League circulated a petition to have Iva pardoned by then-President Ford. They contended that she was the victim of racism and wartime hysteria.
On January 19, 1977, President Ford committed one of his last acts in office, the pardoning of Iva Taguri. She is the only person to have ever been pardoned for treason in American history.
In 2006, Iva died in Chicago at the age of 90, having finally, for the last few decades of her life, been able to retreat to a rather quiet life.
Iva Taguri's life was one full of unfortunate circumstance and exploitation at the hands of the people around her. One bad decision snowballed into a lifetime of defamation and accusations that she would fight tirelessly to overcome.
However, Iva always kept her stripes, remaining loyal to the country she called home.
In the end, after decades of fighting, Iva succeeded in reclaiming her identity, not as the infamous and traitorous woman of legend Tokyo Rose, but as American citizen Iva Taguri.
Thanks again for tuning in to Female Criminals. We'll be back Wednesday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Female Criminals, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time. Female Criminals was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Female Criminals is written by Kaylee Huffman and stars Sammy Nye and Vanessa Richardson.